We're going to continue in this series of sermons. We've been looking at the idea of Sabbath and recovering the rest of Sabbath, looking at, you know, the actual practice of Sabbath itself, but even more deeply asking about what a practice of Sabbath teaches us about how to view all of life and all of time. And today we're going to be talking about invitation and warning. We'll get to that in just a moment, but I want to start by talking about puzzles. I have very, very fond memories of being a kid and being at my grandparents' house and them getting the newspaper. This is not a thing we got at my house, this newspaper thing. My grandparents got the newspaper. And I remember thinking, looking at their newspaper, how boring it was. Black and white, no pictures really, lots and lots of words, most of which I didn't really understand. But once a week, there was a redemptive aspect of that newspaper. It happened generally on Sundays. It was a full-color print of the comics. And so, you know, I loved Garfield and Family Circus and things like that as much as the next person. But what I think I actually loved more was, anybody remember Slylock Fox? I had to look it up. I had to make sure I had the name right. I was pretty sure I did, so I Googled it. And Slylock Fox. And Slylock would occasionally bring to the funny pages something like this. You guys remember these? The spot the differences puzzle, where you would have these two pictures that at first glance look pretty much identical, but then you're tasked with, all right, find the differences in these puzzles, and you would stare at it and stare at it. And I'm sure by now you've all stopped paying attention to me and you're trying to find the differences. It's fine. I planned for this. Fun fact, they still make these new all the time. You can find them on the web. So I did bring the answers for you because I knew we would not be able to get through this without having the answers to the puzzle. There are, I think, six differences. Are you ready? Here we go. There are eyeballs here, but not here. There's a banana peel. The tip of the banana peel here is different from over here. What else do we have? There's a can label on this can, but not on this can. There is a fork that is bendy right here, not bendy over here. There is a bone right here coming out of this envelope, not one here. And the last one is the hardest. It's the bird's beak is actually longer over on this one than on this one over there. What did I miss? Two bones. Doggone it. Oh, yeah. Yeah, that bone. There are two bone differences. I have to say, I'm a little disappointed that I know this is the peak amount of attentiveness to the sermon we will have the entire day. It's okay. I'm here for it. So in the book that I'm using some of the ideas and some quotes from The Rest of God by Mark Buchanan, he talks about this idea of similarities in a much more meaningful, intimate way. He talks about having identical twin daughters. And he says, you know, my identical twin daughters, he said at first, I actually had trouble telling them apart. But as I got to know them over time, there are these slight differences. The way they smile, the little bit differences in the cadence of their voice, the way that they walk, slightly different. He said to everyone who doesn't know them really well, yeah, they look basically the same, but they're different. He put it this way, it's like hearing a single Mozart piece composed and played by two different but equally skilled orchestras. Both of his daughters were equally wonderful, valuable, and beautiful to him, but they had these slight differences even though they were identical. Puzzles like this, at first glance, seem to be identical, but if you look closer, you see that there are differences, even slight differences. So, why the talk of puzzles and twins? Because today we're going to look at twin passages in Scripture. And maybe you're not aware of this. I'd actually forgotten until I read about it this past week. There are two listings of the Ten Commandments in your Bible. The one we're most familiar with is Exodus chapter 20. The one we read is a part of the Exodus story where the people have escaped the slavery of Egypt. They're by the mountain, the whole stone tablets, the whole thing. But did you know it's also listed in Deuteronomy chapter 5. Deuteronomy is the law again, or a retelling of the law. And so it's there as well. What we're going to look at this morning is we're going to get to the Sabbath portions of both of these passages, and you will see they're very, very, very similar, but there are slight differences. and those slight differences make a big difference in helping us understand what I would just call different lenses of how and why Sabbath is important. So here we go. Let's look at the Exodus one first, Exodus 20. Remember the Sabbath day by keeping it holy. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work, but the seventh day is a Sabbath to the Lord your God. On it you shall not do any work, neither you, nor your son or daughter, nor your male or female servant, nor your animals, nor any foreigner residing in your towns. For in 6 days the Lord made the heavens and the earth, the sea and all that is in them, but he rested on the seventh day. Therefore the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and made it holy. So, that's the first twin, the one maybe you're most familiar with. Now listen and read along with Deuteronomy 5 and pay attention for those slight differences in what you hear and what you see. Observe the Sabbath day by keeping it holy as the Lord your God has commanded you. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work, but the seventh day is a Sabbath to the Lord your God. On it you shall not do any work, neither you, nor your son or daughter, nor your male or female servant, nor your ox, your donkey, or any of your animals, nor any foreigner residing in your towns, so that your male and female servants may rest as you do. Remember that you were slaves in Egypt, and that the Lord your God brought you out of there with a mighty hand and an outstretched arm. Therefore, the Lord your God has commanded you to observe the Sabbath day. So did you see the slight difference? The slight difference of the why. Here's the Sabbath. Here's how it works. Here's what it should look like. Here's how widely it extends. But then the why is a little different in each of those passages. In the book, Mark Buchanan puts it this way. Exodus grounds Sabbath in creation. Deuteronomy grounds it in liberation. Exodus remembers Eden. Deuteronomy remembers Egypt. In Exodus, Sabbath keeping is about imitating divine example and receiving divine blessing. In Deuteronomy, it is about taking hold of divine deliverance and observing divine command. Exodus looks up. Deuteronomy looks back. One evokes God's character, the other, his redemption. One calls us to holy mimicry, be like God. The other, to holy, that should say holy, not hold, holy defiance, never be slaves again. One is an invitation, the other is a warning. Therefore, the title of today's sermon, Invitation and Warning. These are slightly different. It doesn't make one valid or invalid or one better than the other. There are two lenses through which we can help understand all of the depth of what it means to Sabbath well. So let's start by talking about this. Are you aware that God does not need to rest? Ever. God does not need sleep or rest of any kind. God is entirely and eternally whole and complete without rest at all. Don't believe me? Passages like Psalm 121 verses 1 through 4 remind us of that fact. I lift up my eyes to the mountains. Where does my help come from? My help comes from the Lord, the maker of heaven and earth. He will not let your foot slip. He who watches over you will not slumber. Indeed, he who watches over Israel will neither slumber nor sleep. If I were to poll the room, I would imagine many or most of us at some point in the past when we were children were afraid of the dark. For what reason? I don't know. There's nothing inherently threatening about darkness. But I think it's the fact that we can't see anything. And when we can't see anything, we get scared. It's the fact that we feel more alone in the darkness, and so we get scared. I think it's even true that as kids, even when we are dark, within the safety of our own homes, we still are a little scared of the dark. Why? Because what if a bad thing happens in the dark? What if you, as a child, are snuggled cozy in your bed, but what if a monster emerges from that closet? Or crawls out from underneath that bed? Not only is it dark and you're alone, but here's the kicker. Mom and dad are sleeping. Our God never sleeps or slumbers. Psalm 121 is part of what are called the Psalms of Ascent. It's a group of psalms that are bunched together. Sometimes they're even listed with that heading in your Bibles, a song of ascent. These were songs that were sung by travelers, by Jewish travelers who would travel from wherever their homes were located all around ancient Palestine, and they would have to go to Jerusalem. Really, three times a year, according to the law, they'd have to go for the Feast of Passover, Pentecost, and the Feast of Booths. And that kind of travel was not always safe travel. There were mountains along your route, and there were oftentimes bandits hiding in the mountains waiting to prey upon a person or persons who strayed too far from the larger group that could provide safety. And so these Jewish travelers would sing these songs together to remind themselves, when I look to the mountains, where does my help come from? My help comes from the Lord. Imagine if the journey is more than a day long because they didn't have luxuries like cruise control and the internal combustion engine. And so maybe, can you imagine yourself sleeping somewhere under that gigantic night sky and feeling a little bit more alone, wondering who's watching out for me, and being able to sing or hum to yourself, the one who watches over Israel never slumbers, never sleeps. That God is able to watch over each and every one of us at all times. Buchanan puts it this way: God never sleeps or slumbers. He runs no risk of breakdown, burnout, or exhaustion. God doesn't need a Sabbath or sabbatical. He doesn't pine for vacation. He doesn't require a good night's sleep to clear his head or steady his hand. God is never waiting for the weekend. And I hope that that last line, I can't confirm this, I hope it's a little subtle nod to the 1980 rock song, Waiting for the Weekend by The Vapors. I kind of hope that that's true. I can't confirm. But I read that chapter and thought, well, yeah, duh. God doesn't need vacation. God doesn't pine and wait for the weekend to come. But think about how powerful that is, that our God doesn't slumber or sleep. He needs no rest. He can be attentively watching over every single one of his creatures at every single moment. Incredible. So then that raises the question, though, if God doesn't need rest, why does God choose to rest? If God doesn't need it, why does God choose to do it? And the answer is pretty simple. Because you do. And I do. God may not need rest, but we definitely do. Although we stretch it as far as we can most of the time. Do you have any idea how long a human being can go without sleep? By the way, I chose this picture. I was looking for a good picture for this slide. And like, this kid is just living her best life right here. Zonked halfway on the couch, one boot on, one boot off. Like, that picture just makes me so happy. But how long can a human being legitimately go without rest? What's your personal record? Not that we should brag about these things, because it's kind of sick to do so. But I will say, for me personally, my personal record happened in college. I had decided to date a young lady, and I invested enough time into that that I put off my studies for a while, and it was a worthy investment. I ended up marrying her. But during the time, I put off enough projects and papers and whatnot and studying that I had to stay awake for 50 consecutive hours to get it all done. The scariest part is when I got to the end of 50 hours, I wasn't tired anymore. That kind of scared me. But I played some Mario Kart and fell asleep, and it was all good. We stretch it, and we strain it, because we think, I don't really need it. How long can humans go? There have been some studies done, some scientific studies, where they watch really carefully over the people in the study, very, very scientific. And typically, those studies show us that humans can go somewhere between 8 and 10 days without sleep. Which, if that doesn't just make you want to take a nap, I don't know what would. But the record, as far as we know, the world record for most consecutive hours without sleep belongs to a guy named Randy Gardner, who in 1965 decided for his science fair as a 17-year-old that he would see how long he could go without sleeping, and he made it 264 hours, approximately 11 days, without sleep. Now, they say that by the end of that time, he was technically awake, but he had lost all cognitive function. He was cognitively dysfunctional by the end of his 11 days without sleep, which makes sense. Listen, like nothing else in nature, we fight this need for rest. If you've ever played with a dog or a cat or whatever, and they get tired of playing, what do they do? Do they push through to be more productive? Nope. down. They're done. They don't fight it. We as humans, we fight this. This design for us to be creatures that need rest. Renowned sleep researcher Wills Webb said this, "Sleep is a gentle tyrant. It can be delayed, but not defeated." So God in his grace not only tells us what to do, but God shows us what to do. God leads by example even when it doesn't apply to him. Think about it this way. If you have ever had a child or a grandchild, someone who has been playing and stumbled and fallen and maybe has a scratch or a boo-boo, something that is treated with peroxide or rubbing alcohol to clean out the wound, you get out that bottle of whatever it is, and what's that child's first instinct? It's going to sting. And so what do? Sometimes you will put some on your own skin to show them it's fine. Not because you need it, but because you're trying to coax them into it. Buchanan tells it a little differently in the book. He says, how many of us trying to get a grumpy toddler down for a nap have ever said, you need to take a nap? No, I don't want to. Listen, I'll lay down next to you. Not because you need a nap, but because they do, and you want to show them by example. Although, how many of you then fall asleep next to them after giving them the example? God in his grace doesn't just tell us, but he shows us, even though he doesn't need it. Buchanan says the Exodus command, with its call to imitation, plays on a hidden irony. We mimic God in order to remember we're not God. In fact, he says, that's a good definition of Sabbath. Imitating God so that we stop trying to be God. Sabbath has so many benefits, many of them practical. Rest for our bodies, our minds, our souls. But one of the sort of hidden benefits of Sabbath is this reminder that the world can go along just fine without you for a while. And for some of us, that's maybe a little humbling. But we need to hear it. We need to know that the world continues to turn, even if we decide to rest. So that's the invitation side of it. God says, come, enter into this rest. I've built it into creation and into who you are. The warning side is interesting. You know, the warning side from Deuteronomy. I brought you out of slavery with my mighty hand, my outstretched arm. In essence, saying, don't go back. Deuteronomy 17 says it this way, talking about the king. The king, moreover, must not acquire great numbers of horses for himself or make the people return to Egypt to get more of them. For the Lord has told you, you are not to go back that way again. Now, yes, this command is specific. It's for the king. It's among a group of commands for the king and how the king should lead the people of God. And it's specific about not going back for horses, but it's also tied to this general idea that seems to be repetitive. The Lord has already told you what? Don't go back that way again. Listen, that command is not just about horses. It's not just about the physical land of Egypt. It's about not going back that way again, meaning the way things were. Don't go back to that way of living again. Don't go back into the slavery that God has rescued you from. Because when God's people lived in Egyptian slavery, listen, rest was unthinkable. As a slave, there's no choice about when you work or how long you work. There's no vacation day. There's no coffee break. And as slaves, they became less human. They were merely machines. They were gears in the machinery of the Egyptian economy. And God now says to his people as a part of the Sabbath command, don't go back that way again. I brought you up out of that. Don't go back to it. I might put it this way, to ignore the Sabbath command is to lose out on your humanity. To refuse to rest is to become convinced that you are just a human machine, only valuable when you are producing. We choose to believe that. We choose to go back that way again, a way that God has rescued us out of. Our culture puts a premium on productivity, and often we absolutely fall for it over and over again. Buchanan says it better than I do. He says, here's the logic of the Sabbath command in Deuteronomy. Don't revive what God has removed. Don't gather and piece back together what God smashed and scattered. Don't place yourself in a yoke that God broke and tossed off with his own hands. Just as we ought not to pull asunder what God has joined, so we ought not join what God has pulled asunder. And I read that last bit and I'm like, I use that language all the time. During a wedding ceremony, you get to the end, right? What God has joined together, let no man separate. The idea that when God brings these things together, we want to avoid pulling them apart. And if you've been divorced or you know someone closely who has gone through it, you know that there is so much hurt and grieving that comes along with that process, the pulling apart, pulling asunder what God has joined together. And so Buchanan's point is this: why don't we experience the same grief when we put back together the things God has pulled asunder? God has pulled us asunder from a lifestyle of believing that you're only valuable when you're productive, and yet here we are trying to push it back together again. God took it and broke it into pieces and shattered it with his mighty hand and his outstretched arm, and what do? Sometimes we try and smash it back together again. What God has pulled asunder, let's leave in broken, tattered pieces. Let's not go back that way again. That's the warning side, an invitation and a warning. And I think maybe the hardest part about this warning is that we're so far removed from ancient Egyptian slavery. We try and think about the taskmasters that they suffered under before God brought them out and through the Red Sea and into the Promised Land with the new law, including the Sabbath. It's kind of hard. But we still have taskmasters today. They may not be hovering over us with whips like those Egyptian taskmasters in the ancient world, but listen, they loom over our lives nonetheless. They're mostly invisible, these tiny little taskmasters of half-truth that sort of put shackles and chains on our minds when we start to think clearly or try to think clearly about Sabbath and what it means and how it works and how it can work in and through and for us. And they're really troublesome because they're very effective lies, because the most effective lies, you probably know, are the ones that are rooted in little bits of truth. And that's what these tiny taskmasters are. They're half-truths. They sound like this: there's just so much to do. Or maybe they sound like this: you're just being lazy. Or maybe they say, you know what? You're going to let people down. There are people waiting for you, depending on you. You're going to let them down. Or maybe they just say, you know what? Do you really deserve to rest? And here's the thing about all those taskmasters. There's a little bit of truth in them. Because like, there probably is too much to do. And you might be, from time to time, a little bit lazy. I am. You might let people down by choosing to live life through a Sabbathing lens. And yeah, you might not deserve to rest. And Buchanan makes this point in the book. Here's the thing: God doesn't care one bit about your rights, what you have the right to do. God cares a lot, though, about your needs. And he has said to us, you need rest. You need Sabbath and all that it brings into your life. And so all these little invisible taskmasters are constantly whispering into our ears, giving us all these many reasons why we don't deserve or shouldn't grab hold of the invitation and the warning that God gives us about Sabbathing. So I want to finish with a few things to think on and pray through, to let these things sort of sink into our hearts. And these are located in the bulletin if you want to continue to think and pray about them during the week this week. But in this moment of silence and reflection, just take rest in the truth that God doesn't need rest. Just thank him that he's able to watch over us in each and every moment. And all of us, everyone in this room, and not just this room, like this city and this globe, God is able to watch over each one of us. He never slumbers or sleeps. Secondly, are there any aspects or areas of your life in which you are trying to be God? Are you struggling to rest because you might be afraid of what will happen if you relinquish control? Third, think about the average rhythm of your week, and then ask, what can you do differently to humanize a person who's easy to look past as a gear in our economy? This sort of comes from that idea of the Hebrew slaves just being gears in the Egyptian economy. And I'll just give you one example of how I've tried to do this in my own life. I've been trying to do this for several years now. As I try and use a drive-through as seldom as possible. Because what I found is that when I go through a drive-through, I just kind of view the person handing me whatever it is, whether it's a bank envelope or two chalupas or whatever it happens to be, they're just part of the machine that gives me what I want. But by parking and going in, I see people. They're not just machines, they're people. Anyway, just one idea. Here's the last one. Do you have any taskmasters looming in your life, and what kind of lies are they trying to tell you to pull you away from the Sabbath that God has designed for you and given you as a gift? So I'm going to scroll through those as always. Whatever one just sort of grabs you at some point, just close your eyes, bow your head. Whatever it is in this moment of silence as I still my voice, let's let the voice of the Spirit speak to each of us, and then I'm going to pray to close that time in just a moment.